Welcome to Knowing God in the Word, brought to you by the Word of Truth Ministry, publishers of Seed and Bread. I'm your host, Bob Juno, with Bible teacher Nathan Johnson. This radio program is for the purpose of helping listeners fulfill the greatest need we have as believers, to know God. Today, Nathan will continue his teaching series on the book of Judges with Samson and Delilah. And now, Bible teacher Nathan Johnson.
Thanks, Bob. Toward the end of the history of the book of Judges, we saw that the Israelites were enslaved to the Philistines for 40 years, until God raised Samson, the mighty judge, to deliver them. When his Philistine wife was slaughtered, he attacked the Philistines and started a war with them single-handedly. The men of Judah were not willing to fight for Samson, but he attacked the Philistine army with a donkey's jawbone, and with that flimsy weapon killed 1,000 of them, chasing their army out of Israel. And then he judged Israel for 20 years. We discussed last time that for all his moral faults and all his self-centeredness, that Samson is still an excellent example to us of complete confidence and faith in the power and presence of God with him. Yet today we go on to Samson's later life to see that he seems to have suffered from a midlife crisis and returned to the sins of his youth. And we see that as we start in Judges chapter 16 and in verse 1. Now Samson went to Gaza and saw a harlot there and went into her. So Samson, after 20 years of judging Israel, he seems to get restless. And he leaves Israel and he goes back into Philistine territory and he goes to Gaza. This is another Philistine city, one of their 5 primary cities. And Gaza means the strong. So this was what they believed was a strong city. And he sees there another Philistine woman who is a prostitute. And he goes to visit her. Well, once again, we see that Samson is not interested in his fellow Israelite women, but he's only interested in the bad girl, quote-unquote, Philistine women. And this is typical to Samson. But interestingly, it's been 20 years since he did this. And assuming he was a young man, maybe in his late teens, when we saw what happened last time, well, he's crowding 40 now. And so it looks to me like Samson might be having a midlife crisis. Now, what is a midlife crisis? Well, I think when human beings are young, we tend to look at it as if our life is stretching out in front of us. And when you're a kid and you're anxious to grow up, but somehow you kind of figure when you grow up and become a young adult, you'll just stay as a young adult for a huge length of time. And then sometime way off in the future, you'll become old. And what actually happens is you find that you grow up, you hit young adulthood, you seem to go rushing through it, and next thing you know, you're facing the middle of your life and you're facing old age coming just around the corner. And what happens, and this seems to happen with men a lot, is that they say, oh, no, I'm still young, I'm not that old. And they want to go back and do stupid young people type of things to prove to themselves and to anyone else who cares that they're not really that old. And we call this a midlife crisis. Some men, as they go out and they buy some kind of super muscle car, and they're not young anymore, so they can afford the things. But they, you know, they always wanted one when they were young, so they pretend they're young. But sometimes, sadly, as they go out and they get a young woman, flash their money or whatever advantages they have from being in the middle of their life and try to get some young, hot chick to run around with and forget about their aging, middle-aged wife. Well, Samson, of course, didn't have a wife. His wife had gotten burned up in the fire caused by the cycle of revenge between him and the Philistines. But he goes back to Philistia and goes back to the sins of his youth with this Philistine, this time just plain a prostitute, Philistine woman. Now, what can we say about God's people and midlife crises? Well, to me, it's very understandable that people of the world would have such a thing. People of the world are constantly trying to convince themselves that their life is long, that their death isn't going to come anytime soon, that it's way off in the future. And the more that becomes obvious that that's not true, the more they try to deny it. They try to keep themselves busy. They try to do things. They try to entertain themselves. They try to drink alcohol. They try to do anything but remember that death is coming. And yet it is. Death is like a sword hanging over our heads. And I say that Adam's race is in the sad and ridiculous position of running around with a sword hanging over our heads, ready to drop any time, that is, our own death. And yet we run around imagining that we're gods. Well, what fools we really are. But the thing is, when we come to know Jesus Christ, and when we realize that we have a resurrection life awaiting us after this one, well, we can see that it really doesn't matter when this life starts to get on, when this body starts to get old, when, as a favorite Bible teacher of mine used to say, there's more sand in the bottom of the hourglass than there is in the top. We realize that though in this world we can't flip that hourglass over and live the days of our youth again, that we will get to the point where the sand runs out and we'll die, that God can flip that hourglass over again, that he can bring us back to life, and that this time, the sand in the hourglass is unlimited. This time, it's a life forever he gives us. A body that doesn't wear out and die. A body that doesn't get old. Eternal youth. As far as what we think of as youth goes, but really it's unnatural to grow old and have your body wear out. That came into the world because of sin and death. When we realize we have another life like that waiting us, well, who cares if you hit middle life? Who cares if your death is coming? Who cares if there's more sand in the bottom of the hourglass than the top? We have another life. Just like when your shoes start to wear out, you go out and buy new ones so you're ready. In the same way, in Jesus Christ, we're ready for when this life wears out. And there's no reason to have a silly midlife crisis and try to convince yourself you're young. We can face aging and old age with the courage and confidence that knowing God brings. Samson, though, well, he was an Israelite and should have realized these things. Samson, well, he was clever. We saw that with the case of the jackals. And yet he doesn't seem to be a very deep thinker, very self-centered. And so it makes sense that he would struggle with the idea of himself getting older since he was the center of his own life. So he goes to Gaza and visits this prostitute. Verse 2, when the Gazites were told, Samson has come here, they surrounded the place and lay in wait for him all night at the gate of the city. They were quiet all night, saying, in the morning when it was daylight, we will kill him. So the Gazites found out that Samson came and that he was in their city. Now, the Philistines were not fond of Samson. Remember, he had basically humiliated their whole nation when he had defeated their army single-handedly. And we can imagine that they hated him. And they think, aha, now he's come into our city. We have him in our power. So they surround the city. They close the gates. They set up a guard. They say he's trapped here. Now, they don't want to try to get him that night, because, of course, it's too easy for him to escape in the dark. Plus, I don't think they relish the idea of facing Samson in the dark. When he's one man, he doesn't have to worry. Anybody who's around him, he can kill. Whereas they are likely to kill each other and not know who is the one they're trying to fight. No, they want to wait till morning and capture him then. So they surround him. They set the trap for him. And they're waiting for him. They figure he'll try to leave the city through the gate in the morning, and then they'll capture him and kill him. Verse 3. And Samson lay low till midnight. Then he arose at midnight, took hold of the doors of the gate of the city and the two gateposts, pulled them up, bar and all, put them on his shoulders, and carried them to the top of the hill that faces Hebron. So Samson lay, well, the New King James added in that word low. I think it means he lay with the prostitute till midnight. And I don't think he was concerned with this trap. He wasn't laying low. He was just enjoying himself with the prostitute. Well, midnight comes, he's done with her, and it seems that he's somehow aware of his danger. Now, I don't know how this happened. If he was, like I said, he's a clever man in a lot of ways, and he figured that they would have found out he was there and had set a trap for him, or whether he had somehow got tipped off, some Philistine was careless and let him see them preparing their trap for him. But he seems to know that they are trying to capture him, trying to kill him. But he is unconcerned. At midnight, he gets up. He goes out to the gate of the city, walks right up to it, and he takes hold of the doors of the gate of the city and the two gateposts. Now realize what a city gate was about. Back then, when people were so warlike and every city was kind of every man for himself as far as cities were concerned, each city had to protect itself and its people, They built these walls to be protection and without gunpowder and without missiles and things that could blow through a wall. A wall was a great protection. And so the wall was how they protected themselves. They built it high, they built it strong, so an enemy army couldn't knock it down. Now, of course, you couldn't have a total wall because then you couldn't get out of the city yourself just to do business and to visit your farms and to get food. So they had to have gates, and yet these gates would be the weak point in the wall. Well, because they were the weak point, they had to build them large, they had to build them strong. They had to build these gates to withstand an invading army. And so these gates were huge. They were made out of huge planks. Their posts were gigantic, pretty much trees set in the ground. Giant, powerful gates. Now, at this point, I think we have to ask ourselves a question, and that is, was Samson, as he is often pictured, a huge, muscly, wrestler-looking guy? Was he a Herculean-looking guy? Because the fact is that even a huge, muscly wrestler guy couldn't lift the gates of a city. Basically, the human frame isn't built that it could do that. Those gates were so big they would crush anyone. You couldn't lift them, no matter how big and muscly you were. And the most any big, muscly guy could maybe do is if he had the ropes hooked up right, he could maybe drag the gates by himself with his great muscles, maybe for a few hundred feet. But no human being, no matter how strong and muscly, could lift the gates and put them on his back and carry them. No, they would crush him. They would crush his bones. He couldn't do it. The human frame doesn't have the structure to lift such a thing. So I don't think Samson even had to be huge and muscly. He could just be a normal guy. In fact, he could have been a smallish guy. He could have been string beanie. The fact is that the things he did by the power of God. Now notice again the confidence of Samson. The Lord has helped him in the past. He faced a lion. He tore apart the lion with his bare hands. He faced an army. He defeated the army himself. And yet, as powerful as these things were, he's never done a feat of incredible lifting before. And yet he just walks up to these gates confident that he can do it. Why? Well, again, he figures God has told him he is his deliverer. And if he is God's deliverer, God's going to give him the strength to do whatever he needs to do to live. And God does it. And this is the supreme confidence Samson has in his God and in the power of his God to empower him to escape whatever situation he's in. Now he pulls the city gates up by the gateposts, bar and all. So they are locked. Well, he doesn't care. He just rips them up locked. Puts them on his shoulders, still locked. And he carries them on his shoulders. Now I suppose all he'd do is carry them a couple feet and drop them and run away. But he doesn't run, and he doesn't drop them. He carries them, and notice where he carries them to the top of the hill that faces Hebron. Now Hebron, which means joining, was David's first capital. Before David took over all Israel, when he was just the king of Judah, he ruled from Hebron. Now we need to understand, where was Hebron compared to Gaza? Because we might think that Samson just walked out the city gates, carrying the gates in his back, walked up a nearby hill and deposited the gates there. No, Hebron was 37 miles from Gaza, or 60 kilometers from Gaza. And that is as the crow flies. And Samson carries these huge gates that entire distance. Now, I would have trouble carrying a backpack 37 miles. And he's carrying a city gate, something that, humanly speaking, no one could carry at all. It's so heavy. And yet for Samson, he just figures, I might as well bring these gates with me. It's like if I picked up a feather and put it in my pocket. If I'm getting tired, I've walked a long distance, I'm going to say, oh man, I better drop that feather. That'll lighten the load. Well, no, who cares about a feather? And Samson doesn't care about these gates. They're so inconsequential to him, it so doesn't matter that he's carrying them, that he just might as well bring them along all the way back to Hebron. And then he finishes this mighty feat of strength by carrying them up to the top of a hill. Again, the last thing I'd want to do if I'd carried a backpack 37 miles is carry it to the top of a hill. And Samson carries these stupendously heavy city gates and deposits them at the top of a hill. Now, I think he was leaving them there because fat chance anyone is ever going to move them from there. They're so heavy, it would take so much work. Why would you do it? But they will sit there at the top of this hill as a testimony that can be seen far and wide to the power that God had given him. Amazing what Samson did, in spite of the ridiculous fact that he got himself in this problem in the first place. But Samson's midlife crisis isn't over after one night with a prostitute, it seems. Verse 4. Afterward, it happened that he loved a woman in the valley of Sorek, whose name was Delilah. So now we read of Samson and Delilah. Now he loves this woman, we read. Well, I've told you before about the word love in Greek in the New Testament. And in Greek, they're much more exact for their word for love than we are. We talk about, I love pizza, I love sports, I love my husband, I love my wife, I love my kids, I love my parents, I love my friends, I love God. We use the same word love for all these things. The Greeks are more exact. They had different words for different kinds of love. But in Hebrew, that the Old Testament was written in, they were much like we are. Their word for love, ahav, is very inexact. It doesn't tell us exactly what kind of love it was. And we see that Samson's love for this woman wasn't much. Basically, he liked her because she was hot, I think. Now, she lived in Sorek, which means choice vines. No doubt a place of vineyards. And it was actually a valley that was in between two of the great Philistine cities, Ashkelon and Gaza. Now, the woman's name is Delilah, which means weak. So he is the strong man, and he's with this Philistine woman who's named Weak. Verse 5. And the lords of the Philistines came up to her and said to her, entice him, and find out where his great strength lies, and by what means we may overpower him, that we may bind him to afflict him. And every one of us will give you 1,100 pieces of silver. So the Philistine lords see this as another chance to get to Samson through this woman. Now, Philistia, as far as we can tell, had 5 major cities. And so if the lords of the Philistines came, these were probably the 5 lords of these 5 major cities. So when they promise her 1,100 pieces of silver, we have to take 1,100 times 5. This means they promised her 5,500 pieces of silver. Now, that is a great sum. That's a lot of money they promised her, great wealth. And these Philistines say, why are we offering you this wealth? To find out where Samson's great strength lies. See, they well realize that his strength is not natural. He didn't just keep lifting until his muscles got so strong that he could do these things. No. No, they realize there's a supernatural power behind his strength. And they figure there must be a secret to overcome it. Now, they're looking at it as if it was magic. And Samson uses magic to have his power, so there must be some magic way to overcome it. Well, this is pretty superstitious, their view of it. But the fact is, they were right. There was a secret. It wasn't magic. It was his relationship with Jehovah. It was Jehovah who gave him this strength. That was the secret. But they were looking for some kind of magic secret. Well, what does Delilah do? Verse 6. So Delilah said to Samson, please tell me where your great strength lies, and with what you may be bound to afflict you. Well, she loves him so much that she doesn't think twice, I think, about trading him in for 5,500 pieces of silver. I'm being facetious, of course. I don't think she loved him at all. To this woman, money is better than a man any day. I mean, think of all the men she can get with that much money. So she tries to trap him by wheedling out of him the secret. And she takes up the idea of the Lord's, that there is some magical secret that if she just knew what it was, his strength could be overcome. Well, Samson plays along, verse 7. And Samson said to her, if they bind me with 7 fresh bowstrings, not yet dried, then I shall become weak and be like any other man. So Samson plays along. She wants the magic reason he has so much strength, and what magic could be used to undo his strength. So he plays along and tells her a magic solution. Well, all you have to do is take 7 fresh bowstrings. They haven't been dried yet. They're green. And then tie me up with them. And then I'll become weak like any other man. Well, that was a complete fabrication. He just made that up out of thin air. But she asked for a magic secret, and he views it as a joke. And so he jokingly comes up with a magic way to overcome him. Verse 8. So the lords of the Philistines brought up to her 7 fresh bowstrings, not yet dried, and she bound them with them. So, of course, they try it. The Philistine lords are so anxious for this plan to succeed that they bring her the bowstrings themselves. And she does it. She ties him up with the bowstrings. Now, how did she manage to do this? Did she pretend this would be sexy or something? Oh, it would be so cute if you were helpless, Samson, and, you know, makes a big sexual game out of it. Something like that, I suppose. But he doesn't realize, probably, verse 9. Now, men were lying in wait, staying with her in the room. And she said to him, "The Philistines are upon you, Samson." But he broke the bowstrings as a strand of yarn breaks when it touches fire. So the secret of his strength was not known. So she has men waiting in ambush, hiding in the room. Now, how do you hide men in someone's bedroom? I mean, not just one man, men. Could you hide men in your bedroom? I wonder about this. Well, assuming she was kind of a wealthy woman, maybe she had what we would call a big walk-in closet, or maybe some changing room, and there would be a curtain hanging in front of that room, and so these men are probably hiding in there behind the curtain. Maybe you could get up to maybe 10 men hiding in there. So they're hiding, and she does this thing, probably pretending this would be so sexy and cute. If you were helpless, I tied you up, and ties him up. And then all of a sudden she says, "The Philistines are upon you, Samson." But what does he do? Is he helpless? Has the magic got him? No, there was no magic. And he breaks these bowstrings like yarn breaks when it touches fire. Like burnt yarn. Just snaps. He just snaps these bowstrings like they're nothing. It's nothing to him. Verse 10. Then Delilah said to Samson, "Look, you have mocked me and told me lies. Now please tell me what you may be bound with." Well, she continues to work on him. She complains that he lied to her. "You didn't tell me the truth. You didn't trust me, Samson." Well, I wonder, how is this working in Samson's head? He knows that after he told her this, she did what he said to her. And then there were these men lying in wait to take him. Maybe he didn't know that. Was she able to get Samson out of the room and then the men sneaked out so he didn't know they were ever there? Or did they act like it was just a joke? "Hey, Samson, these are these friends of mine who are hiding in the next room. Ha ha, funny. These are my friends." Or, I wonder, does Samson well know what's going on? He knows, "Huh, she's trying to trap me, but I have my strength, and so who cares? And she's hot. Whew. So I don't care if she betrays me. I just want her. I'm in no danger. Who cares if she's trying to betray me?" Well, I wonder, but what kind of woman is this that Samson's attracted to? Ready to betray him, and he doesn't care. Well, she begs and pleads with him. So verse 11, so he said to her, "If they bind me securely with new ropes that have never been used, then I shall become weak and be like any other man." So he tells another lie. He makes up another magic spell. This time he says, "Use 7 new ropes that have never been used before for anything. And that's the magic. Then I'll become weak like any other man." Notice he uses 7 again. Well, 7, as we read through the Bible, is a number God often uses. And probably that's part of Hebrew culture, that 7 is a special mystic number. And he uses that in his pretend spell. Well, of course, Delilah tries it again. Verse 12, "Then Delilah took new ropes and bound them with them and said to him, 'The Philistines are upon you, Samson.' And men were lying in wait, staying in the room. But he broke them off his arms like a thread." So again, Delilah ties him up with him, maybe saying, "Oh, this would be so cute if you were tied up and helpless." Well, it doesn't work. Again, men were waiting in the room. Though we don't read the Philistine lords came this time. Maybe they were disgusted after the last time. But when she says this, well, he breaks the ropes like they're thread. And yet Samson is playing with fire. And the fire will burn him eventually, as we'll see next time. So Samson reached middle life and returned to the sins of his youth. As we face middle life and face aging and getting old, we should have confidence in the life God has for us after this one, and not panic and have midlife crises when we see our later years coming. Samson takes up with Delilah, who has no loyalty to him and is willing to take money to betray him. Well, again, we should learn from Samson's mistakes that if we want a marriage partner, we should look to God's people for a partner, for a real partner, and not to the bad boys or bad girls of the world. Well, let's learn these lessons from the mistakes of Samson.
Once again, we see Samson taking a Philistine woman to be his own. Israel's oppressors used Delilah in two separate plots to discover the secret behind Samson's great strength. But we will have to wait till next week to see if Samson can remain faithful to Jehovah, the God of Israel. Thank you, Nathan, for your lesson on Samson and Delilah. On our next program, Nathan will continue his teaching series on the book of Judges with Samson's sad defeat. Thank you for joining us today. Our hope is that as you study God's Word, you know and love God more and more. For more information on the program, to hear past programs, and for other downloadable material that Nathan has produced, please visit our website at knowinggodintheword.org. I've been your host, Bob Juno, with Bible teacher Nathan Johnson. So long for now, but we look forward to you joining us next week on Knowing God in the Word.